Hi, and welcome to another episode of Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz in the windy and rainy Portland.
Because it always rains and it's windy in Portland.
It's just like, tonight, Brandon. This is the one night of the year it rains in Portland.
It's like the poor man's Seattle. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my gosh, that's so classist of you. Oh, that's unfair.
Which, but I've never been to Portland, so I have to go, and then I'll judge it there, and people don't kill me when I get there because I just made that joke about Portland. Anyway, so tonight we have a very important episode.
Great guest.
We sat down through Skype with director Adam Saulke. He's directed two feature films. His first one was Dare, which was based off a short film he did at Columbia when he went to grad school there. And he turned into a feature, and he had a lot of great people in it. A young Rooney Mara, Alan Cumming, a lot of
great scene.
Great, like a lot of great actors in it, and some of them before they got really big. So it's a film you can check out. And he also
on Netflix
and Showtime, as Wade tells us later on. Also, too, his most recent film, I Smile Back, was in competition at Sundance Film Festival in the dramatic competition. It was also in competition at Toronto International Film Festival this past year. The film stars Sarah Silverman in a very dramatic turn for her. She's kind of known for doing comedy roles, and she took a very different path for this one, and it was very entertaining. Also, Josh Charles, who has been a number of things, from Dead Poets Society, if you guys know from way back then, Aaron Sorkin TV show Sports Night, and he was also in recently Wet Hot American Summer, the TV series on Netflix. He kind of he goes back and forth between drama and comedy a good bit. Also, of newsroom fame, we have Thomas Sadowski in the movie. And he was in,
it's a great cast. The
it's
whole
a great
cast is exceptional.
Great cast. I think a lot. I mean, all of them, they bring their A game to me. And so Ben and I, we watched both of Adam's films before for this. And
we did our homework.
Yeah, I saw I Smile Back before we ever decided to interview or ask Adam to come on the show. I was there for a Q&A with him and Sarah Silverman at Sundance Cinemas on Sunset. It was opening night, I think, here. Packed house. It was a great showing. A lot of great questions afterwards. Really enjoyed it. I mean, it does. It's a great depiction of addiction and alcoholism, drug addiction, just kind of a person spiraling out of control in some way. And it shows that things like that, suffering from depression, is not just focused in on a certain class or demographic. We don't know what's behind closed doors is kind of what's interesting about the film, and it shows that to us, and very entertaining. And Ben watched
well
it recently.
Yeah, and Adam's got a great summary that he gave in a couple other interviews that we didn't actually get into our interview.
No, we didn't.
We just jumped right into it. But he summarized it in a really beautiful way, which is I Smile Back is a story about how a person can come to be broken and how hard it is for someone with such a big heart to unintentionally end up breaking other people, especially her loved ones. I don't know. Like, there's just, it's a poignant summary, and it's a poignant film. Like, it's got a really great performance from Silverman. That's a lot of the reviews focus on that.
But it
works on so many levels and in so many ways because of the cast around it, because of the direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautifully shot. There's some really stunning moments. You know, especially I sent you guys a couple screenshots in the chat. I don't know if we can include them in the show notes or whatever, but it's really beautifully it's really beautifully shot. So it's worth checking out on VOD.
VOD. You can get it on iTunes as well. It's great. Great editing as well. I know we talked about that in the show. It's a great film. It reminded me a little bit about a movie called Days of Wine and Roses, directed by Blake Edwards in the I think 50s or whatever. It's with Jack Lemmon. Very reminiscent of that. Or it's Sarah Silverman's performance is very, I think, very in line with Michael Keaton's performance in Clean and Sober, another older film about drug addiction and alcoholism. And so it's very in line with her. And Silverman follows the path that had kind of been laid with Keaton and with even Robin Williams and Jim Carrey of comedians who decide to show a more dramatic performance. Because I think she's talked about this in other interviews as well, of how comedians have it's difficult, but they have that other, that dark side of them they can actually bring out and tap into, because comedians are people who look at the world differently, and a lot of it is in a dramatic, it's like they're taking dramatic issues and making them comedic. And that's something we talk about in the show as well, about how certain comedies nowadays don't do that as well, because some certain comedy films from back then really dealt with dramatic issues. And but Sarah Silverman, great performance, and hopefully we can see her in more roles like this. So yeah, it's a great interview. Adam was gracious with his time to actually talk with us for almost an hour, and it was
buckle up, people,
because we asked some hard hitting questions.
It's a good interview. He's a very kind hearted person, yeah, and he
gave us a lot of great information. And hopefully we can have him back on the show at some point. And we hope you enjoy this interview. Also, make sure you check out I Smile Back and Dare. You can even follow Adam on Twitter. See what all he's up to. It's a great interview. We hope you enjoy it. Tonight, guys, we have director Adam Salke here, and he had his last film, I Smile Back, was recently shown at Toronto International Film Festival and Sundance Film Festival, and Adam's one of the 16 directors to have both of his first two films shown at Sundance Film Festival in Utah. His first film was Dare, which is in 2000.
In dramatic competition.
In dramatic competition. I knew I was going to mess that one up.
There have been way more than 16 films shown at Sundance.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, exactly. But yeah, so Adam's here. Adam, so gracious with his time to actually his busy schedule to talk with us about his career, his process, and kind of I Smile Back. I saw I Smile Back recently when it came out in L.A. in theaters. Ben,
good man.
I don't know if Ben told Adam yet, but Ben did it on VOD.
Oh, good, good.
Didn't come to Portland, but I did get to watch it on VOD the other night.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you guys for supporting the cause.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, Ben loved it. See, he'll just go ahead and tell you. I mean, we talked about it after he watched it, and our other friend who's in the podcast, he woke up to 250 text messages from us about the movie. So
250?
We have a group message for the show, and yeah I mean, I watched it. You're throwing me under the bus here, Brandon. You're making me look like a super fan, but I did love it. Let's be honest.
That's awesome, man. Thank you so much.
I really loved it, and I guess I'm gonna jump right into it.
Please,
Brandon.
Do.
You tell me.
Okay.
I mean, here's the thing. I saw the promotion for the film. I was excited to see it at some point, right? And then after seeing it and I felt a really strong connection to it, you know, based on the topic.
Same.
You know, Silverman gives an excellent performance. A lot of people have talked about that. You know, it centers around like depression and addiction and all these sorts of things that I think are important things. That's why I want cinema to exist, right? It's the type of film that I want to be out there. Yeah. And then to read through some of the critical response, it infuriated me, like at a basic level.
Some of the good ones.
I did read many of the good ones.
Yeah,
there are
did,
a lot of
did.
Good ones. So I don't want to open on a negative here. I'm not.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. Okay. Richard Roper did a good one recently. I read, and then a couple other. What was it? Did Peter Travers, Rolling Stone.
Did he do yeah.
A good
Peter
one?
Travers gave okay. a great one.
Okay.
There were quite a few really, really good ones. So I'm not upset
that not everyone loved the film is what Ben is trying to say. And
well, look, I appreciate that. You know, I don't. Yeah. I'm just going to respond to what I imagine the question is, which is something along the lines of, how do you feel about that?
How do you deal with something like that? I guess is another question.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an evolving thing. You know, with my first feature with Dare. I couldn't read them, and I didn't. I didn't read any of the reviews of that film. And, you know, a friend or David, the writer, you know, would tell me, oh, it was good or it was bad, but I didn't read any of them until about almost a year later.
Yeah.
And then the reality is that it's hard. You know, if the review is great, then it's inflating your ego, and that feels good. But is that good for you? Probably not. If the review is bad, then it hurts your feelings. So, you know, I was at the time couldn't find the positive aspect of reviews. But then over time, I started to realize that, you know, it's just, you should be able to, now I read them, and you really should be able to read them and take your critical eye to the critic and say, you know, is this person saying something that I can learn from? You know, because that is the point of criticism. Now, whether or not a lot of criticism is actually doing that, I think is a separate issue. But, you know, but I do think it is valuable to look at them and say, you know, I'm striving to grow as a filmmaker and as an artist, and you know, is there something here that I can use? So I do that.
Yeah. No, and I think that's really interesting. I mean, what I want to try and get down to from that is this idea that some of the you know, response to it in some of these reviews is that basically, you know, it's because it's almost in a way like because of the setting, like because she's privileged and because she's a suburban mom, you know, that somehow it's like her struggle is less valid. And then the other kind of angle is like, well, this isn't the way we should talk about depression and addiction in a sort of like high-minded, like if we were, I don't even want to, I get frustrated even saying that because I think it's so,
well, let me just say first that, you know, from my point of view, the film has been reviewed incredibly. And I love it. I mean, obviously, we've had great reviews. We've had bad reviews. We've had some in the middle. Yeah. But you know, 99% of the reviews that are, you know, have it take issue with the film still go out of their way to say that Sarah was great in the movie, which I believe is true objectively. And so I look at those as good reviews in a way. But the thing you bring up, which is actually, you're absolutely right, and now it makes me feel like you did read a lot of the reviews, for better or for worse. You know, there is an issue that is brought up, and it's there are, you know, certainly some number of reviewers who are irked by the socioeconomic setting of the film. Yeah. To me, it's actually and you know, again, that's their opinion, and that's all good. I mean, to me, it actually underscores the mystery and the tragedy of some of the, you know, people who are struggling with these things. Right. That the character of Lainey, played by Sarah, has resources.
Yeah.
I mean, she can go to a nice rehab facility. You know, she has access to medical attention and high quality medical attention. And even with all of those things, it still isn't enough to, you know, not to give away too much what happens in the end, but ultimately to save her.
Yeah.
And so to me, that just says something about the confounding nature and the mystery of some of these problems.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the setting was important in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm arguing for that last like half star to give it five, you know what I mean? So I'm totally, and it's much more, the setting to me does make sense because it's much more of a focus on the, kind of this inner, like one of the questions that I, you know, prepped or whatever and have now wandered off from is this idea that like both films, Dare and I Smile Back, you have these protagonists who for the most part have these really complex internal struggles, but their characters are defined by like this ennui, this listless like inability to kind of directly address it in a way. Like, can you kind of, I feel like that's one of the common things between the films, and it's not intentional, I don't think but talk about the struggle of bringing some of those characters, because in the book, right, the internal monologue of her character is such a key feature.
You read the book too?
I did not read all. I did not read all the book.
You started.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's okay.
I guess talk about the challenge of bringing a character to the screen that is defined by this like rich internal struggle that's not immediately present in the dialogue and things.
The truth is, it's the most difficult thing to do cinematically, and it's something that, you know, when I have taught, and I have taught you know, at USC's graduate film program. Should we just
say what's happening here?
That, you know, Brandon was one of my very talented directing students. Why I got the invite to be on this awesome podcast. But I guess he liked my class enough to have me here. But you know, that's why in a film school setting, very often they are trying to get students to write characters with clear external goals.
Yeah.
You know, I want to defeat the villain, or I want $1 million so I can, you know, buy this thing so this girl will love me, or whatever it is. And and the reason being because one of the things that is most challenging to do in film is for the camera to show an internal state.
Yeah.
And for me, I suppose it's just something about the material that I'm attracted to, or some of the material that I'm attracted to, that, you know, I've chosen these stories to direct that have these complex internal struggles. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's just something that attracts me, in storytelling. So I'm stacking the cards heavily, in the challenge category, you know, to try and bring audiences into the inner tumult of a character. And, mm-hmm. and in some ways, you know, Dare is very interesting structurally there because it's a triptych film, and there are three acts. And in some ways, the internal struggle of the characters gets more complex and more nuanced as it goes along. So Alexa, played by Emmy Rossum, who has the first act, has the most outward goal, you know, that she wants to kind of, you know, be great actress in this like school production, which is a very clear goal.
Right.
And Ben's goal is also clear, but he has more of an internal struggle. And Johnny's goal is a little more emotional and more sophisticated, and him sort of wanting a family with these friends. So maybe went on a little long there.
Yeah.
Feel free to hop right in.
No, you're fine. Now, the internal struggle you're talking about with I Smile Back, I think you did a great job with it, mainly because of the way the film was edited, especially during...
Tamar Amin, editor.
Yeah, the editor.
Really great. She cut a film called Sound of My Voice.
Okay.
Which, if you haven't seen, you should really see. It's really great. And I'll tell you a funny story. Basically, I was living next to Tamara. I didn't know that she was an editor. And I was in my apartment preparing, you know, doing some prep work on I Smile Back, and I was watching Sound of My Voice because I really loved it. And it's a very low budget film, and I Smile Back, you know, had a budget of just under $500,000. So it was in the neighborhood. And I get this text from Tamara basically saying, hey, you know, we're making dinner. Do you want to come over? And I just moved into the apartment, and I was sitting there thinking to myself, yeah, you know, I'm going to go be friendly with the neighbors. Like, I'm going to do it. And so I go over there, and we're having dinner. And in the middle of dinner, there's like a little lull in the conversation. Having a great time getting to know my neighbors. And there's a little lull in the conversation. And I just say, hey, have you guys ever seen this movie, Sound of My Voice? I really love it. And she goes, I cut that movie. And I was like, you cut that movie? I was like, you have to cut my movie. She's like, what's your movie? And we hired her to cut the movie.
Wow.
So it's all, you know, being friendly with your neighbors and what that can lead to.
That's huge brownie points if you organically just, hey, have you guys randomly seen this film that's really amazing? It's like, I made that film.
It was
you
weird.
You were forever on her favorite list.
It was weird. It was just a weird moment where things came together. And, you know, she was a really wonderful collaborator. Anyway, I kind of interrupted you, so you were to tell that story, but you were saying about the editing.
Oh no, the editing. Oh yeah, the internal. I think especially during certain segments when she's talking to the doctor and the rehab stuff, you did a great job of using, I guess, intercutting the things that were going on with what she was saying was what helped, I think, develop the internal struggle, and that helped us see what she was going through. By using the therapist as the way to talk to, but then also showing her elsewhere trying to just deal with it, I guess.
There was a very specific design element that went into the visual storytelling in I Smile Back that was specifically intended to help try and bring people into this woman's journey. And it actually has been something that, going back to reviews, that some of the reviews have picked up on. They have talked about my use of close-ups. Was the way in which they articulate it. But basically, it was a design element that, you know, Sarah Silverman is going to be in every single scene in this movie. Mm-hmm. And from a visual point of view, I am going to stay with her, and I am often going to be very close to her, and I am going to try and, in very specific moments, not cut, to just sort of force you into this person's emotional experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, hopefully it works.
I think it did
for sure. Some percentage of the people, at least.
Yeah. We got it. Don't worry. forget the ones who didn't.
You can't please them all.
You can't please them all. But yeah, great performances all around. Also, I want you to talk about, because I know you talked about it in class, was how much prep do you do going into a film? Because I know you do a lot of prep.
I do.
And I don't know if you would be willing to talk a little bit about what you think is the importance of preparation for a film.
I mean, to me, it is the absolute key thing you can do, and I'll just say that I'm not alone. You know, I just posted an article on my Twitter on Variety about how different, you know, like some of the top directors, Ridley Scott, Danny Boyle, you know, how they prep their films, and the first one is Ridley Scott, and he just says, I sit down and I start drawing the movie, and I draw every single frame. You know, and so the preparation is everything, but it's really a two-part thing. I mean, I will break down every single scene using this thing called the detective work, which I picked up when in film school from my professor, Nick Preferis, and which I gave to Brandon in his class and other classes that I've taught, that really is a scene analysis of really understanding on a deep subtextual level what's happening in the scene. And then I will also, maybe not for every single scene, because some things you may want to remain fluid depending on how you want to do it, but I will also do a paper edit of the movie, kind of like what Ridley Scott is talking about doing, so that I know exactly how it is I'm going to shoot it. Now, all of this, the real interesting thing about this director's preparation is that you have to be ready at any moment to just throw it out the window. But you do, you know, because things change. I mean, you start rehearsing with Sarah Silverman and Josh Charles, and Sarah Silverman and or Josh Charles has an idea, and, you know, that idea is maybe different, maybe better than what you had, in which case your thing goes out the window, or they don't like your idea, and you have to either persuade them to do your idea, or you have to open your mind to what they're talking about and see if there's a way to do that. And, you know, those kinds of things happen on set all the time. So, you know, you have to be ready to, you need to be the most prepared person there, but you also have to be ready to, like, get rid of it.
Well, and let's talk about this too. I mean, you mentioned the budget for the film, but also with the budget comes a shorter shooting schedule. I mean,
20 days
is what I've heard. Yeah. So while
it was hard, said, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. While the actors are coming up with ideas and you have your own ideas, I mean, talk about that ticking time bomb of daylight and time that's dripping away with every deliberation.
Well, you know, when people ask me what the most difficult thing in directing is, it's the clock, you know, that, you know, the increasing time pressure, which every shoot experiences, you know, ones that are shot in 12 days, 20 days, or 60 days, you know, there is always this clock ticking. In particular, for a small film like I Smile Back, like, you know, you're never coming back to that location. Like, you're just never, like, that is it. You know, you are walking. It really, to be honest, what it felt like was walking on the edge of a knife or a tightrope, you know, with knives below you. That at any, you know, at any moment, if there was any misstep, or we didn't get what we needed out of that scene, or I didn't get the right moment, or whatever it was, that the whole thing could kind of come crashing down. It was intense. It was a very difficult shoot. Very tough.
And how big was your crew? Because I know you talked about that Sundance, or the Sundance screening, that wasn't incredibly large.
Incredibly small crew. We had one grip. Yeah. We had one grip. It's really a credit to Eric Lin, the cinematographer, and how much he was able to do with so little. The crew was about between 12 and 14 people, depending on the day, which is really...
That's really
small. That's really context. Small. That's really
that's smaller than some student films. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's super small.
Who do like 20 people for a short 10-minute film.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, look, everything, I think, you know, everything is relative and depending on the project, you know?
Yeah.
If this movie was always designed to have an aesthetic that was hopefully matching the, you know, raw and unflinching nature of the material. So it was never meant to be this really glossy thing. Mm-hmm. By the way, just going back to the reviews, there was one review I read where someone was like saying how glossy and beautiful it was, and I was like, wow, did we watch the same movie? But I don't know. But
I read some of them, and I just really wondered if the person was watching the film. Like, I'm with you. Like, what are these people talking about?
There's this really great.
It made me mad. Just like, if I had made this and people said this, I would lose my mind.
There's this really great satirical article in the New Yorker. I don't know if it's today or written by Jesse Eisenberg about. It's mm-hmm. called the perfect movie review or something like that. Or mm-hmm. anyway, it's sort of a satirical look at criticism. But anyway, how did we go there? Yes, Eric Lenz. So, you know, he really was able to do so much with so little, and he was, you know, a really incredible collaborator.
Yeah, I mean, I usually like to take the like short little time that the credits roll to kind of collect my thoughts after especially a film with the subject matter like I Smile Back. And I was shocked as I saw the credits roll by, because it's like cast, crew, music, music licensing, and then it's over. And I was like, how is this real? How is this a real thing? I was so impressed.
Thank you.
With what came out of that.
You know, there does seem to be a certain level of shock coming from people when they hear how much it costs. I guess that it does make me feel good. I mean, in the end, mm-hmm. you know, like there is a lot of, I feel like filmmakers tend to have interest in this idea of, oh, you spent X, but it looks Y, you know, right. You spent 500,000, but it looks like 3 million, you know?
Right.
And that is kind of an insider, you know, ego thing, when in reality, it doesn't, to me, it means so it's just, did the aesthetic bring you into the story? Because all of decisions that went into where the camera is going to go and the color correction and the music, all of that, you know, was about trying to get people to go on the journey, mm-hmm. you know? And if it worked, then great. And if not, then it doesn't matter if it was 500. I don't think that, you know, another $1 million would have made a difference. But I would have taken it.
Oh, you would. I think everyone would always take the saying is like the two things you need the most you can't really always get, and that's time and money.
Yes, it's true. Although the weird thing, and maybe this is really, you know, the reason why it maybe doesn't feel like a movie that had the budget that it had, is because, and I found this to be true. And I hope not too many of my future producers or financiers are listening to this podcast, but it is true on some level, which is that
odds are they are not.
When you have no money, mm-hmm. you very often have to trash your first, second, and third idea and really get to the root of what your creative problem solving just has to be on point. And so what you end up with very often might even be better than if you had more resources.
Yeah, I agree with that, because I know what y'all taught at USC, or the producing side, was how we have a very limited budget on the short films we make.
Yes.
And sometimes the reason is because I know certain people at certain film schools who don't have a limit, and they kind of throw money at the situation to fix it, and they actually don't think as creatively as they would if they had less money.
Oh, there's nothing more excruciating than watching a short film that you know was made for like $200,000, and mm-hmm. and the story isn't there.
Yeah.
I actually, to me, it's a distraction. You know, like the more money and effects and cranes and all the stuff you see on the screen, if it's not supported by a great story that required that aesthetic, mm-hmm. then it's just, mm-hmm. to me, it becomes a very irritating, difficult exercise to watch. And for all of the film, upcoming filmmakers out there, I will just, you know, say my friend, Madeline Olnick, filmmaker from my class in film school, got her first short film at Columbia into Sundance, and she spent like $800 on it or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really about the voice and mm-hmm. the story. And if your movie has voice, artistic voice and vision and a story, and it was made for $50, it could get into Cannes. Madeline, I'm sorry. I hope you weren't keeping that budget number secret after all these years. The truth is out.
We just beep it out later.
No, that's the pep talk we all need, though, right?
Yeah, it is.
It's this core push to have an emphasis on story and preparation, like you're talking about, and not on quibbling over which red Dragon X sensor you have.
Look, we all want the toys. The toys are fun. They're sexy. But it's not, in the end, it's no one cares. It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
Look at Thomas Vinterberg's The Celebration, one of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's shot on a single chip, you know, like home video camera. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, it had $1 million budget and they're using like the best Danish actors that, in the world and, you know, good sound design and the score and all that stuff. But the visual by design is just pixelated, and the story is so potent that it just becomes a part of it.
Yeah. I've got one, Brandon, unless you want to continue down this path of
ask your question.
Is it about critics?
No, is it about critics?
We could potentially edit that out if it's gonna it's gonna haunt me in my dreams now. No, instead of being known as just the guy who asks questions about critics, if you could make, I mean, now with these two films, that have done really well, Gone to Sundance and all these things, like if you could make anything, this isn't necessarily just like a next project question, but like if you could make anything, what would you want to make? Like what's the
dream project?
Yeah.
You know, I really would love to make a sci-fi, as far as what that is and the scope, I'd love to make something big and that really connected in that genre. Mm-hmm. But I also, would love to make something smaller, like a Moon, that just has a great story, but works in a future world or something. That stuff, I've always loved it as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I would love to do it, and I'm working on it.
Okay, that's good to hear.
We'll put it down on the calendar.
I Smile Back in space.
In space. Yeah. I mean,
look. In the end, it's all about. It just comes back to story and character. Yeah. And if that, trying to create something now that, but that exists in that genre.
Yeah.
That's exciting to me.
One question I have: I've heard you say to aspiring filmmakers to write their own scripts.
What did I say?
You said to write their own scripts. Yes. We've watched a lot of interviews prepping for this.
Yeah, we're going to catch you in your lies. This is an intervention.
And so one thing that was interesting, you tell people to do that, but I've also noticed that a lot of your films were written by someone else.
Yes.
And I wanted to kind of know what your process was with working with a writer, a script written by someone else instead of yourself. Because I know a lot of young filmmakers, they feel like they have to write and direct. And that also, too, if there is a writer-director thing, there's almost sometimes no collaboration whatsoever. So I kind of want to know what your process is with working with another writer.
Sure. I'm sort of hearing two questions in there.
I know. It's kind of two questions.
You know, when it comes to working, I the answer is that both things are true. I love working with writers. Mm-hmm. To me, that's exciting because it's collaborative. You know, if you have... And if you have a project that you both care about and you have a good collaboration, then you really can, in the same way that you can with your cinematographer and your editor and your composer, you can push each other to make it better than it would have been on its own. Mm-hmm. And I really love that. I also feel that when you're coming to something as a director, you haven't written the script, there's a real opportunity there. In that you have just a little bit more objectivity than the writer has who's been living with that material. And it's in that objective point of view that you have on the material before you lose your objective point of view and it becomes more subjective, that you really can elevate something beyond what it was when you first got it. And that's just a special experience to have that collaboration with someone and have them, to be in the room and going over the ideas and having them feel like, oh God, yes, like this is going to make that scene so much better. And oh my God, this is like a great moment that wasn't in there. And oh, this part didn't make sense. And we're clarifying it. And you just feel like, you know, to me, the collaboration is the most fun part of all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first part. I love working with writers. The second part is there's a lot of sides to it, but my advice stays the same. If you want to have the greatest degree of control over your career, it's certainly you're certainly in a stronger position if you have written the thing and you know you can control everything that happens to it.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, there are some practical sort of entertainment industry related aspects to writing your own material, which is that there are so many filmmakers out there. I mean, the competition, mm-hmm. it is very different than Spielberg and George Lucas were. I mean, look, they had competition too, but not the same. You know, there really weren't that many film schools back then, and there weren't that many people out there trying to do, or as many people as there are today.
Mm-hmm.
And with that influx of, let's call it talent, whether it's good or bad, there's just, you know, not as much material out there floating around, mm-hmm. or jobs, as you might look at it if you're, you know, out there hustling trying to make studio movies, for example.
Yeah.
Right. So if you know, you may have all the talent in the world as a director, but, you know, if you can't also have a hand in generating the material, you might not ever be able to apply that to, you know, a good story. So I highly recommend doing the writing, and mm-hmm. I'm doing that too. I spent 3 or 4 hours on it today.
Now, do you have a routine every day where you're trying to write, or is it just when inspiration comes?
No. When I'm being good and doing the writing, it's actually a very structured thing. And the thing, the thing that I read something that I really loved that I've been trying to implement, and if it's useful, maybe it'll be useful to, you know, your listeners, but, or to you. But basically, there's a New York Times article, it's called Relax, You'll Be More Productive. And it's basically about, basically this consultant who does this, you know, work consultant, basically, work efficiency, they interviewed a bunch of, like, famous actors, athletes, musicians, you know, people who really have accomplished great things, and they really were trying to figure out their work habits. And what they realized is that these people are really working, like really concentrating and working only like 4 or 4.5 hours a day. And they found that a lot of them broke that up into 90-minute sections.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, wake up, have your breakfast, get yourself ready, sit down to write, look at the clock, turn off your Wi-Fi, very important, put your phone in airplane mode, very important.
These are the hard parts of all this.
Yes, and and just hit it for 90 minutes. Now, when I first tried it out, I realized that there's a very freeing aspect to this system,
mm-hmm.
which is that 90 minutes is not so bad. Like, it's really not so bad. Like, you can see the end coming, and you can kind of be like, okay, that wasn't so bad. Mm-hmm. And then after 90 minutes, you can, you know, turn on your Wi-Fi, turn on your phone, have a healthy snack, go for a walk, do some exercise, do something, mm-hmm. come back, do another 90 minutes. And then basically do that 3 times a day as a way of being most effective. And I've found that I really like that system.
And there was another thing you told us in class one time was how you say you turn off your Wi-Fi and phone after 9 o'clock at night, to where you wouldn't get anything that would be given at that time can't be fixed till the next day.
Yeah, to me this is essential, in particular as one gets older.
Yeah.
I'm a little older than you guys, but the reality is that a young body can take a lot of stress, you know? And a young mind can take a lot of stress in a way that as we get older becomes more difficult. So I think in your 20s, you know, you can we email all night, you know, go out and look and meet people and read things and go to plays and go to movies and experience all kinds of different things and really just, you know, experience things and mm-hmm. build yourself as a person. But, you know, I have found that if I don't start unwinding my mind mm-hmm. at night, then I have very difficulty sleeping, getting to sleep. Or if I do get to sleep, that the quality of the sleep is not very good. So one of the rules I have instituted, and I'm actually pretty hardcore about this, Mm-hmm. Sometimes I slip on the weekends, you know, but but basically, in particular on a school night, I will not check email. I will turn off my email. I will not check my phone's email after like 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, because there's nothing. Because if some message comes in, some stressful work thing or whatever, and my mind starts going, like, you know, you can't fix anything. There's nothing to happen. There's nothing to be done at 10, 11 o'clock at night that can't actually be done at 8 o'clock the next morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yes, I highly recommend that strategy. In particular, you know, look, most of the people who are doing what we're doing are, you know, on some level have a sensitivity to them. You know, if you are writing or directing or acting or, you know, making music, you know, there is some aspect to you that is, you know, susceptible to stress. I mean, everyone is, but I think maybe in a slightly more heightened way. And so if you want to have a long career, you got to work to start building the habits to minimize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's great. It ties into one of the things that you said at a Sundance interview, is that you said, like, the hardest part about making your first film is keeping momentum.
Yes.
Even in the face of soul-crushing setbacks. I immediately rewound and typed all that out.
It might be true for your second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth film.
Well, I didn't think it was tied to just one film. I wanted to, like, instead of hearing, like, particular setbacks, though, I'm curious, like, how do you... Because soul-crushing setbacks is the best way to describe most of what it feels like in creating things. I mean, how do you push forward, especially on that first one, when it's a 4-year process and there's like just lulls in between? How do you stay on track? How did you stay on track?
It was different, slightly different then than it is now as I've gotten a little older. Yeah. It's a very good question. You know, there was something to me, in particular, in film school, a lot of push making dare happen when I was, you know, at the tail end of that process is when I said that in that interview, was happening during film school. And one of the things that was happening during film school was that I genuinely felt in an organic way that I loved what I was doing, and that I felt that I was, it just felt right. Mm-hmm. And to push that a little further, it felt like I was meant to be doing it. Now, not necessarily meant to succeed at it, or not necessarily meant to make a huge movie that lots of people go see and that gets 100% on Rotten Tomatoes or whatever it is.
Right, right.
But like, sorry, we went back there. But like, but you know, that it felt right. And so I just had a drive. You know, I had a real drive and a real focus on making a feature. I just had this thing in my head, and I just kept at it. I don't know if that's applicable to anyone else, but I just kept finding ways to push the ball forward. You know, and I was also working with a close friend and collaborator who I met at Columbia who wrote Dare, David Brend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of pushed each other. And there were moments when he wasn't feeling it, but I was, and I pushed him. And moments when he had ideas and I didn't have ideas of who to send the script to and how to push the ball up the hill, you know. And so that happened. And so we... You know, I think, you know, that's where that collaboration came into play, that there was, I wasn't alone with it. But I think if I was, I still might have, I hope I would have found a way. You know, I just kept pushing. I didn't give up. I believed we were going to do it.
Yeah. And so I guess, like, would you say that that's like a defining characteristic of your personality? Like, would your parents have said that, like, you would never give up during T-ball, or, you know, not to go back to origin stories or anything?
No, I think a lot of this is a surprise to my parents, on some level. But my defining characteristic, I have doubts, you know? I mean, I have vulnerabilities, and I've made mistakes. But, you know, it's weird. It sounds cliche, but again, while I was in film school, I was watching some Star Wars documentary or a news thing, and the interviewer asked George Lucas, like, what was his advice? And he said, believe. Just believe that you can do it. Mm-hmm. And at the time, that didn't necessarily resonate with me so much. But I do, it did lodge in my head, maybe because he's an iconic figure and he's made iconic work that so many people love, including myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I do remember kind of filing that away, and there is something about that, just some kind of like stubborn belief that you're just going to keep going. I think it's easier, again, if it's organic, you know? Mm-hmm. Like if you arrive at just like, this is what I love and this is what I'm going to do. And by the way, I feel that now it's maybe there maybe should be slightly different goals for young filmmakers. You know, in 2003, when I was in film school, when I started film school, mm-hmm. it was a feature, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I definitely feel that a lot of my students now still have that drive, and I think that's a wonderful thing. But there are so many other things out there now, you know? Yeah. There are people who've become more influential than the top movie stars through their own drive and their own belief in their work on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So does it have to be a feature?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I mean, one of the most eye-opening things I've seen recently was a study. There's been several studies done now. One was conducted by Variety, and it was like, you know, they interviewed 1,500 teenagers of who their favorite influencers were.
Yeah.
And the top four were YouTube stars I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
No, and like that. The fifth one was Jennifer Lawrence or something like that.
Right. I've seen those studies and it's mind-boggling.
Makes sense.
Yeah. There are things happening that are maybe beyond the realm of the feature film right now mm-hmm. that, you know, that in all honesty interest me too. You know, I mm-hmm. feel very blessed that I've been able to tell these stories that, you know, make these two films that I really care about. Mm-hmm. You know, and I hope to make more, and I'm certainly working on it and still trying to believe mm-hmm. when times are dark.
Mm-hmm.
But they do get dark sometimes, but you know, mm-hmm. I lost my train of thought there. YouTube. No, just that there are different things. There are different, mm-hmm. I'm interested in some of that stuff too.
Well, I know, like, you look at Entertainment Weekly magazine, and like you have just as much promotion for films as you do YouTube channels. Like, it's kind of crazy of how it's becoming a new outlet. And a lot of young filmmakers, they're so focused on making features, they forget that they can create a brand or use their voice in a way that is like on YouTube and not just a feature. And I think that's something that young filmmakers kind of write off and don't focus on as much as they could.
Hmm.
It could help them.
I'm looking to you, Brandon. I'm looking to you. I'm looking to you as the new generation coming out of film school and what you are doing. We can save that for another podcast, but I'm curious.
Hopefully it'll be good. Yeah, we have a few more questions so we can wrap up for you. So the first question actually comes from our other podcaster, Thomas Horton, and we're big Newsroom fans on this show.
Uh-huh.
And we really want, or he, his only question to you, which is kind of sad, was he wanted to know what Thomas Sadowski is like.
That is, Tommy Sadowski is a wonderful, sensitive, incredibly talented human being, artist, and performer. And mm-hmm. you have already, by loving his work, you know,
oh gosh,
seen that side of him, but he's the I would love to work with him again. He is the exact kind of person you want to have on your team. Like, if he's making your movie, mm-hmm. he cares about it, and he's going to engage with you on that level and bring you something that is, you know, insightful and maybe even surprises you. He was wonderful. He was really great.
Yeah, I just started watching Newsroom from them convincing me to do it, and they talked about to watch out for Thomas Sadowski. And
speaking of the YouTube of it all, by the way, he was cast in part over Twitter.
Really?
So one of the producers, wow, Brian Koppelman, reached out to Tommy over Twitter, and I don't forget exactly what the tweet was, but it was something like, "Hey man, you know, love your work, and we're sending you project." And he was like, "Okay,
oh,
cool."
Man.
So like, you know, there was a there's new media, social media played a role in casting.
You're, for I Smile Back. Back?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. We need to do that to get him on the show. That's what we got to do. Just send him a tweet.
It's worth a try.
Yeah. We might try it. Well, I got one last question for me is kind of a personal one for you is, what are some of your films that inspired you, or top five favorite films that you look toward or that inspired you to be a filmmaker, I guess, or your favorites.
Sure. The movie that really sparked me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were so many. I grew up, I was a movie obsessed, you know, kid. I was not one of these people, and this is a long story, but I was not one of these people who's like, oh, I'm going to be a director.
Yeah.
And maybe there are more people doing that now because film schools are so, are everywhere. But,
yeah,
you know, I really, I just loved films, and it was really in the making of little short films and stuff that I started to, you know, again, organically arrive at this place where I thought I did want to be, where I started to discover that I wanted to be a filmmaker. And then it really was not until after the first year of film school at Columbia that I realized that all of the writing, you know, the writing, directing, editing, producing, all that stuff kind of fell away. And I was just like, I want to direct. It was in going through that process. But so, you know, anyway, so movies, you know, when I was in college. Okay, so again, one more preface. Sorry, but basically,
you're fine.
I went to go see all kinds of movies when I was a kid, but most of them were like, you know, big movies and like horror movies, and I saw a lot of trash, and some of it was great trash, but you know, I didn't have that like weird uncle or weird aunt or whatever taking me to like the art films, and I just didn't even know it really existed. So I went to college, and I went to the theater. Somehow it caught my eye. And I saw Alexander Payne's Election.
Ooh.
And I was just like, I was completely floored with the power of his voice in the storytelling and how specific it was and how different it seemed to me. At the time, I didn't know what he was drawing from and, you know, what his influences were. But I just saw it as a complete, you know, its own thing. And I was amazed by it. And I remember just walking out of the theater buzzing with how powerful it was and also how creative it was and how you could use film to tell stories in inventive ways. And so that was really the movie that you know, really sparked my imagination. After that, you know, I love Y Tu Mama Tambien. To me, that is just... Alfonso Cuarón is my favorite living director right now. I mean, he's just... What he can do visually, how he can create, you know, inventive visuals and match them with story and draw you into something in a dynamic way. I just don't see anyone else doing exactly the same thing. He's incredible. You know, going back to some classics, Billy Wilder's The Apartment. I really love. It just the script. Man, that script is so tight. Yeah. And for a comedy, it's dealing with adultery and suicide and all these things that you don't see in every studio comedy right now, and God bless them, some of them are really funny, aren't generally inherently ridiculous.
Yeah.
No. And, you know, this movie is like dealing with really real things that I really loved. You know, I keep rewatching Lord of the Rings, so that's got to be up there. It's just enjoyable. Okay. You know, I find it to just be endlessly enjoyable. And for my fifth, oh man, there's so many.
We're strict about this five film cap. You cannot exceed
it. I am strict about the five.
Well, my fourth one was really three films.
I don't count. That's one. So that's one that. Full one to me. He shot it back to back to back. It's one full one to me.
Oh my gosh.
You know, I could say... you know, picking these... Student, you know, when you first start a class, you're always asking people like what their favorite films are, and they hate you for it. Now I'm getting, now I'm getting, you know, the return for that
retribution.
Exactly. you know,
he never asked me in class. By the way, I will say that.
Oh, I didn't. Okay, you escaped. You know, I'd have to maybe Rear Window.
Okay,
it's another one that just, you know, the story matched with the directorial design of you know, doing it all through point of view and how that draws you into this character who's just stuck in a wheelchair. Yeah. Really incredible. You know? There we go. Five.
That's five. That works. That works for sure.
You landed.
You landed just like that.
I stuck the landing.
I actually started watching Y Tu Mama Tambien last night for the first time because I knew you love it. So I was trying to. I didn't finish it all before tonight.
You were desperate to figure out why I loved it. what'd you think?
I realized I'm about halfway through with it. Just the way, What was also interesting was that it was not like his first film. It was, I mean, this is after he did a bunch of studio films.
Yep.
That he went and did the face of the film that he would have done like right out of film school or in film school. And right. So it's a really, especially with the breaking, like having the scenes and then breaking it with narration all of a sudden was jarring to me, but really interesting
mm-hmm.
of what he was doing. And just the, I mean, because he uses a lot of, in everything that he does now, a lot of oners.
Yeah.
And it works very, it works, it doesn't have to be a huge, massive thing like Children of Men, but it works very well with just this intimate setting that he has in the film.
It really, in that film in particular, for me, just draws me in because you have mm-hmm. to work. You know, it's yeah. like in the continuity system of filmmaking, traditionally the Hollywood system of filmmaking, you know, that you're given close-ups and you're just given the story. You don't yeah. have to work too hard. But in yeah. that film, in the first 10 minutes or something, there's no close-ups.
No.
And you're just, no. you just have to sort of like lean in and be like, okay, like I'm following the story and who are these people? You have, it engages you. Mm-hmm. And I found that to really draw me in. And I love the omniscient narrator. I think because I was so drawn into the story otherwise with mm-hmm. these, you know, kind of dual protagonists and their very intense adolescent want in the movie, yeah. You know, to sleep with this older woman. And the because I think the narrative thrust is so powerful and so strong, mm-hmm. it like opened up a window where this omniscient narrator could then like tell you about the socio-political environment yeah. and like expand mm-hmm. the world for you. I just found that to be
yeah.
unbelievably inventive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very different that would be like his third. Like he would do that and then do Harry Potter, Prisoner of Azkaban as his follow-up. Yeah.
Well, like well, you know, what's interesting about that is, you know, you look at, you know, this filmmaker, he goes and he just makes like basically an art film.
Yeah.
Probably just not in any way thinking he's going to go do Harry Potter. And the voice in that art film is so powerful that yeah. these, you know, basically commercial interests want him
yeah.
to make their commercial film. It's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that to me, going on a Harry Potter rant, is probably my favorite Harry Potter. I'm sorry, my favorite Harry Potter film is Prisoner of Azkaban because his voice is so strong that it completely sets it apart from the rest of the series to me.
Mm.
That's my personal view on that. I know some people are like that's their least favorite because it's so different from the book, but I was just like the best overall film to me is his.
All right.
But yeah, I think that's all we're gonna do for tonight. We'd love to have you back on at some point if you ever have free time.
We sure, we'll do it again. You. And if Alfonso Cuarón happens to be like your big celebrity audience member and he's listening to this, I'd just love to take you out for coffee sometime, man, and just pick your brain.
That yeah, we'll make that happen. We'll get him as an audience member.
Yeah, I'm counting on you guys to make that happen.
We'll do it. Well, thank you. And so you can view I Smile Back on, is it, you can rent it and buy it off iTunes and Amazon. Yes. Correct.
It's on iTunes right now, and iTunes is on VOD through almost every single cable outlet: Time Warner, Comcast, Verizon, anywhere in the United States of America.
It's worth every penny. It's great.
You can stream Dare on Netflix. Correct.
Netflix and on it's also on Showtime.
Showtime. Yeah. Okay. Cool. But yeah, go and view those film, guys. Adam, thank you again for coming in and talking to us, and hopefully you'll come back soon.
Guys, it was really great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.